And I send greetings from First Mennonite Church of Richmond. And it's good to be back here. I really enjoyed my time with you last year, and I was looking forward to being back with you this morning. And I also know that there's a carry-in dinner afterwards, which made it even more positive to be back here. I'm just coming back from a vacation. I was gone for 2 weeks in the Northwest. I was in Oregon, Washington, British Columbia. My wife and I did a lot of hiking and saw lots of waterfalls, and we don't need to see any more waterfalls for a long time. And but I also came back with a cold. I got a cold while I was there over a week ago, and it's just hanging on a little bit, you know? I mean, I don't think I'm contagious anymore, but, you know, there's just that little bit back of my throat. And so anyway, if I got a bottle of water back here just in case I need to clear my voice. Well, you know, in just a month, in 1 month, is the opening ceremony for the Paris Olympics. And then you're going to have 2 weeks of Olympic competition. And it is estimated that over 3 billion people will be watching the Olympics. That's over a third of the world population. Well over a third of the world population is going to be watching at least parts of the Olympics. You know, what is it about the Olympics that makes them so popular? What makes them so riveting? Well, there have been a lot of great moments in the Olympics. There have been a lot of great athletes, Olympics. Let me, what I think are five of the noteworthy Olympians here. Oh, here we go. Jesse Owens. You know, in 1936 in Berlin, Hitler was hosting the Olympics there in Berlin, and he was hoping to use the Olympics as a way to prove the superiority of the so-called Aryan race. And then Jesse Owens completely demolishes that idea by getting gold in the 100 meter, the 200 meter, the 4x100 relay, and the long jump. One of the great moments in Olympic history. And then, let's see if this works. All right, I'm going to ask Noah to advance it. All right. Nadia Comaneci, do you remember her? The 1976 Montreal Olympics. She was the first athlete to ever score a perfect 10. This was as a gymnast. It had never been done before. In fact, it was thought to be impossible to score a perfect 10. Not only did she score a perfect 10 in one of her routines, she scored a perfect 10, I think it was like 7 times, and she won 3 gold medals. And then 4 years later in Moscow, she did it again a couple more times, and she won a couple more gold medals. In all, she won 9 Olympic medals, one of the greatest gymnasts of all time. All right, the next one, Florence Griffith Joyner. Do you remember her? FloJo. She's considered the fastest woman ever. In 1988 in Seoul, Korea, she set an Olympic record for the 100 meters. She set a world record for the 200 meter, which still stands today. She won gold in the 4x100 relay, silver in the 4x400 relay. And earlier in the year, in the 100 meter, she set a world record, which still stands today. Another great runner, Usain Bolt. He's considered the greatest sprinter of all time. In 3 consecutive Olympics, 2008, 2012, 2016, he won gold in the 100 meter and the 200 meter. It's never been done before. You'd never win those things multiple times like that. And he won gold in the 4x100 meter a couple of times. And he still holds the world record for the 100 meter, the 200 meter, and the 4x100 relay. So clearly the greatest sprinter of all time. But perhaps the greatest Olympian of all is Michael Phelps. Okay, in 2004 in Athens, he won 6 gold and 2 bronze in various swimming competitions. But then 4 years later in Beijing, he won 8 gold, which had never been done before. No one had ever gotten 8 gold. But then in the next Olympics in London, and then the next Olympics after that in Rio, he won 9 more gold and 2 silver. And he winds up with a total of 28 Olympic medals, 23 of them gold. Now, I did have a person in my congregation who objected and said, well, yeah, but there's so many different ways you can swim. You know, there's not many different ways you can run. And so they thought it was unfair that he got all these medals. Well, I if you can do it in 4 Olympics, that makes you pretty good. So these are some of the greats of the Olympics. Now, you may remember that the Olympics began 2,700 years ago in a place called Olympia in Greece. The Greek city-states, which were oftentimes in conflict with each other, decided to have regular games with each other at this sacred site of Olympia. There was no fighting allowed. So during those games, there's no wars. We come together to peacefully compete with one another. And these games were so popular, so successful, that those Olympic Games in Olympia continued for 1,100 years. And then the Greeks, they took this idea of athletic competitions where you bring people together peacefully to enjoy the competition. They took that idea all around the Mediterranean world. And then the Romans took over the idea. And so in the Greco-Roman world, in every city of significance, you had a place where these athletic competitions would take place, a stadium in virtually every city in the Roman Empire. It was immensely popular. And that popularity continues today. For much of human history, we've been riveted by athletic competition. And what is it about it that we find so riveting? And partly it's because we want to see the fastest person. We want to see the strongest person. We want to see the most accurate person, the most skillful person. That's part of it. But also, I think there's a recognition that what we're seeing is the result of years of intensive training. We're talking about people who probably had to start in childhood training for what they're doing now, years later. Everything that they eat, everything that they drink, every hour of sleep at night, every bit of their training during the day, everything is geared toward getting the most out of their body to perform at the maximum level. You know, to compete on the world stage like this, you've got to know what your goal is. You've got to be focused. You've got to be absolutely dedicated. And every part of your life has to be geared toward that goal. Which is why the author of Hebrews sees as athletic competition as being a perfect metaphor for living by faith. Living by faith is very similar to preparation for a race. You see, for the author of Hebrews, faith does not mean giving intellectual assent to a list of doctrines. That's not faith. You know, go back to chapter 11 in Hebrews. Reread that chapter. It's not about what you think. Faith is not about your religious affiliation. Faith is not about whether you go to church on Sundays. Faith in Hebrews is the courageous, self-sacrificing life for God doing God's will. Faith is utter trust in God. Faith is an unwavering hope that ultimately God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Faith is a life of action guided by love. Faith, hope, love, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians. These three remain. These three are eternal. These three are interrelated, intermingle. And when we live by faith, hope, love, we are directed toward a life that pursues the impossible until it becomes possible. That's the life of faith. Now, how do you develop that kind of faith? How do we become spiritual athletes? Well, let's take a look at just one of the verses in our passage today. If we can go on to that next slide. Here we go. Let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us. The word race here in Greek is agon. Agon. It's where we get the English word agony. We base the word agony on agon because to run a race, to be in a athletic competition involves agony. It's painful. All that training is painful. Running as fast as you can until you can't run anymore is painful. It's agony. Do we accept agony as part of what it means to live by faith? We know that living by faith involves joy. We know that it involves hope. We know that it involves meaning and purpose. It has all of these wonderful benefits, but do we also accept that it involves agony, self-sacrifice? You know, American culture isn't really into agony. And the American church tends to not really be into agony. We'd rather be spectators rather than actual actors. You know, our society loves athletes. They love to see other people who dedicate their lives to this really hard stuff and you know, work at it really hard, and we pay them extremely well. But we'd rather watch them than do it. And somehow we think that if a team from our city or from our favorite college or school wins, somehow that means I won. You know, the closest most Americans get to agony and self-sacrifice is sports betting. Okay. So the question is, will we accept agony as part of what it means to live by faith, to live a life of faith? G.K. Chesterton, the famous Christian writer from about 100 years ago, he said this: the Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting as it's been found difficult and left untried. I'm reminded of an old story about a king who had two servants. Now, this king, like many kings, was rather pompous, arrogant, and liked to give orders. And because giving all these orders and making people do what you want them to do makes you feel self-important, right? Well, one of the servants was very good at obeying everything the king told him to do, carried it out immediately. The other servant, well, sometimes he wasn't quite so sure and he wouldn't always follow those orders. And so the king quickly got mad at him and fired him and banished him from the palace. Don't you ever come back here. Now, the first servant went on to become a favorite of the king because he was always obeying the king. He was doing everything. And the king would reward him, gave him this really fancy house, gave him servants. And anyway, one day that servant is thinking to himself, I wonder whatever happened to my friend, that other servant who got fired. And so he left the palace one day. He went into town and he started asking around, you know, does anybody know where, you know, so-and-so lives? And finally, they directed him outside of town. At the edge of town was a shack. And he knocked on the door of the shack and he heard a familiar voice say, come on in. And he opened the door to the shack and he walks in and he's aghast at the deplorable conditions that his friend is living in. It is a dirt floor. There's a few sticks of furniture. And his friend appears to be eating a very watery soup. And the servant of the king, he shakes his head and he says, you know, if you had learned how to obey the king, you wouldn't have to be eating thin soup. To which his friend replied, yes, and if you had learned how to eat thin soup, you wouldn't have to obey the king. The life of faith means learning how to eat thin soup. Because we do not obey the selfish demands of a self-indulgent culture. We obey a self-giving, self-sacrificing, compassionate God. So how do we become spiritual athletes? How do we do that? What's the agony that goes into becoming a spiritual athlete? Does it require hours of prayer and fasting every week? Does it require living a simple lifestyle, perhaps even an ascetic lifestyle? Does it require deep study of scripture every day? Well, I'll be honest with you. All of those spiritual disciplines have been found useful for hundreds of years. They're not popular. A lot of Christians don't like doing them because they're hard. There's agony involved. But they are useful. They can build your spiritual muscles. Now, that may not be, no necessarily, what your spiritual discipline needs to be. But I would ask you to think to yourself, what enhances your hope? What develops your love? Whatever it is, do it. Do it frequently. Do it regularly. And serve others as often as you can in a humble way, and you will be strengthening your spiritual muscles. And according to the author of Hebrews, the most important thing you need to do to develop as a spiritual athlete is look at Jesus. Keep your eyes on Jesus. Look at what he did. Look at his life. Look at his life of love. Look at his life of goodness. Look at his life of hope. Look at his life of deep trust in God. And look at his agony. Look at his self-sacrifice. Learn from that. Follow his example. Do that because he's the pioneer and perfecter of faith. And the author of Hebrews says, be encouraged by the fact that when you're running your race, you're in a stadium being cheered on by a cloud of witnesses. Now, do you know who that cloud of witnesses is? You're going to have to wait a second because I need some water. That cloud of witnesses are all the people of faith who have gone before you. And they are watching you. And they are cheering you on in your race. And you know what? You don't even have to win your race. You don't have to come in first. You don't have to come in second. You don't even have to come in third. Because God has given each one of us our own course to run. You're not in competition. You don't have to beat somebody. God has given you your own course to run. And so the point is not to come in first. The point is to finish the race. That's your job. That's the task that God has put before you. Here's your course. Finish the race. Last June, last year, I went to South Bend because I wanted to be at the retirement of two dear friends of mine, Dave and Janice Yorty Suter, co-pastors of Kern Road Mennonite Church. They'd been co-pastors there for 35 years, and they were retiring from ministry. Now, I knew Dave and Janice. I'd known Janice since I was 4 years old. We went to Sunday school all the way growing up. I knew Dave when his family moved to Lombard, which is where I'm from, when he was in middle school. And we were all in youth group together. We all went to college together. Janice and I were in seminary together. And so after 35 years of ministry at Kern Road, they were throwing this big celebration for them, a two-day kind of event. And I thought, I've got to be there for that. So I went there. And for 2 days, I listened to one person after another talk about the remarkable things that Dave and Janice did as pastors. And they were just so deeply loved. And they made an impact on the elderly, on 10-year-olds, on and everybody in between. I was just blown away by it. And after the festivities were over, I went up to Dave and Janice and I said, you know, you guys have actually had a more fruitful ministry than our pastors, Joe and Emma Richards. Joe and Emma Richards had served at Lombard Mennonite for, 26 years, something like that. And Joe and Emma had a phenomenal ministry. I always thought that Joe and Emma were the best pastors ever. And here was Dave and Janice. They actually had a more fruitful ministry. And I told them that. And Janice right away said, it's not a competition. That's right. It's not a competition. We each have our own course. But you know what? It's really encouraging to see somebody run such a beautiful race. And it's so good to know that the heroes of faith are not just in the past. They're with us right now. They're doing this right now. Let me share with you one more great Olympic moment. Next slide here. Derek Redmond, 1992, Barcelona. He's in the semifinals for the 400-meter race. And he's running on the track, and then he pulls a hamstring. And he's hobbling along, and he's lost the race. You know, he'll never go to the finals. But he decides he wants to finish the race. So he keeps hobbling around the track to try to finish the race. But you know what? He can't. The pain gets greater and greater. He can't finish. And that's when this happens. Next slide. His father runs out onto the track. And while the crowd cheers, his father helps to carry him over the finish line. That is the life of faith. That is the race we are running. We all win when we help each other finish the race.